and there skiffs sit tied ashore, and swamp houses float on skids, their lanterns flickering, but mostly we're alone. There's nothing except us and miles of low, boggy country where the otters and the bobcats live, and moss hangs heavy from the branches overhead. The trees make shapes that look like monsters in the dark. A screech owl sounds off, and both Arnie and me duck low. We hear it pass right over our heads. Fern roots around in her sleep, bothered by the noise. I think of Briny's tales about old Rougarou, and how he carries little children off to the swamp. A shiver runs through me. But I don't let Arnie see it. There's no monsters here worse than the ones that are waiting for us at Mrs. Murphy's house if we're sent back. No matter what else happens, Fern and me can't get caught. I watch the water, and try not to think about what might be out there in the swamp. Arnie turns us this way and that, finding the channel time after time, just like she said she could. Finally, we run out of moonlight, and the kerosene in the lamp goes dry. The flame sputters until it's just the wick burning. The breeze snuffs it out as we draw to shore and tie the bowline to a tree branch. My arms and legs are heavy like the water-soaked logs I've been shoving away with the paddle. They ache and crackle when I crawl to the center of the boat to get under the blanket beside Fern, who's been asleep almost this whole time. Arnie comes too. "Ain't far to the end of the slough from here," she says. And the three of us curl up together, cold and wet, and wanting sleep. From someplace, I think I hear music. And I tell myself it's a showboat, and that means the river's nearby. But it could just be my mind playing tricks. As I drift away, I'm sure there's the sound of the boats and barges far off. Their foghorns and whistles travel on the night. I listen close, try to decide if I know which ones they are. The Benny Slade, the General P, and a paddle wheeler with its telltale puff, slap, 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 puff. I'm home. I'm wrapped in the lullaby I know by heart. I let the dark and the night sounds come inside me, and there's not a dream or a worry anywhere. The mother water rocks me soft and gentle until nothing else is around me at all. I sleep the deep sleep of a river gypsy. In the morning, voices pull me from the quiet. Voices and wood pounding on wood. I throw off the blanket, and Arnie snaps upright on the other side of Fern. We look at each other for a minute, remembering where we are and what we've done. Between us, Fern turns over and blinks up at the sky.
"I told you there's somebody in that boat, Remley."
Three little colored boys stand watching us from the cypress knees, their overalls rolled up above skinny, muddy legs.
"That one's a girl,"
the biggest boy says, stretching out his chin to get a better look at me, and tapping the boat with the end of his frog gig.
"And there's a little girl, too. White girls."
The others step back, but the biggest boy, he can't be much more than 9 or 10, stands his ground and leans on his gig.
"What are you doing here? You lost?"
Arnie stands up and swats a hand at them.
"Scamper off. Y'all had better get gone if you know what's good for you."
Her voice is deeper, like the one she used before I knew she was a girl.
"We've been out fishing. Just waiting on morning to start us up again is all. One of y'all clamber up there and unhitch that line so's we can get on our way."
The boys stay where they are, still watching us, wide-eyed.
"Hurry on now, you hear me?"
Arnie shakes the paddle toward the branch where we're tied. The water pulled us around while we slept, and the ropes tangled in the limbs. It'll be hard to get at it ourselves. I scrabble in the poke and hold up a cookie. In the Sevier house, it's never hard to make off with Zuma's baked goods. I've squirreled some away the last few days to have them ready for our trip. Now they'll come in handy.
"I'll throw you a cookie if you do."
Fern rubs her eyes and whispers,
"Where's Mommy?"
"Hush," I tell her. "You be real still now. No more questions." I hold the cookie up for the colored boys. The littlest one grins, then drops his gig pole and climbs the branch as good as any lizard could. He works at the knot a bit, but he gets it loose. Before we drift off, I toss 3 cookies up on the bank.
No needin' giving them any, Arnie complains.
Fern stretches toward me and licks her lips. I hand Fern and Arnie the last 2 cookies.
We'll have lots of food once we get to the Arcadia. Queenie and Briny are going to be so happy to see us. They'll cook up a mess so big you won't be able to believe your natural-born eyes.
Ever since we started this trip, I've been promising Arnie things to keep her going. I can tell she still wants to be back with her people. It's funny how what you're used to seems like it's right, even if it's bad.
You'll see, I tell her. Once we're on the Arcadia, we'll cast off down the river where nobody can give us trouble. We'll go south, and old Zeed, he'll be right behind us.
I tell myself that over and over and over while we start the little motor and work our way to the mouth of the slough. But it's like there's a line inside me, and it's still tied to something back yonder. It gets tighter and tighter, even after we turn a corner, and the trees open up, and I see the river, ready to carry us home. There's a worry growing in me, and it's got nothing to do with the wakes from the big boats jostling and rocking us around as we putter along toward Memphis. When Mud Island finally does come into sight, the worry gets my breath altogether, and I half wish a runaway barge would plow us under as we cross toward the backwater. What'll Briny and Queenie say when they see that Fern's the only one left besides me? The question gets heavier and heavier as we pass the old shanty boat camp, which is almost empty now, and I guide Arnie into the backwater I've traveled 100 times in my mind already. I've come here from Miss Tan's car, and Mrs. Murphy's cellar, and the sofa at the viewing party, and the lacy pink bedroom at the Sevier's big house. It's hard to believe, even when we clear the bend, and the Arcadia is waiting there, that she's real. She's not just another dream. Zeed's shantyboat is tied up just down the way. But the closer I get, the more things look wrong about the Arcadia. The porch rail is broken out. Leaves and down branches litter the roof. A shattered window shines its sharp fangs in the sunlight near the stovepipe. The Arcadia lists in the water, her hull mired up on the bank so high, I wonder how we'll ever break her loose.
Arcadia! Arcadia!
Fern cheers and claps and points, her sun-gold curls bouncing up and down. She stands in the center of the boat, the way only a river girl can.
Arcadia! Queenie! Queenie!
She yells again and again as we come closer. There's no sign of anybody around. Maybe they got up this morning and went off to fish or hunt. Or maybe they're down at Zeed's. But Queenie doesn't leave the boat much. She likes staying home unless she's got womenfolk nearby to visit with. There's nobody else around here.
This it?
Arnie sounds doubtful.
Must be they're not home just now.
I try to seem sure of myself, but I'm not. A thick black feeling comes over me. Queenie and Briny wouldn't ever let the boat look like this. Briny was always prideful about the Arcadia. He kept things up real nice. Even with 5 kids around, Queenie made our little home spotless. Shipshape, she called it. The Arcadia is a long way from shipshape now. It looks even worse as Arnie steers us close to the gangplank, then cuts the motor so we can float in. When I grab the porch rail to pull us to, a piece of it comes off in my hand, and I almost topple into the water. We've no sooner gotten tied up than I see Silas running down the bank, his long legs pumping through the sand. He jumps over a brush pile, nimble as a fox, and for a minute, I think of Camellia scampering away when the police came. That seems like years ago, not just months. Silas meets me when I climb off the boat. He grabs me in a bear hug and swings me and holds me up over the sand while his feet sink down into it. Then he sets me on the end of the plank.
You're a sight for sore eyes, he says. I never thought I'd see you again.
I wondered, too. Behind me, I hear Arnie helping Fern, but all I can do is look at Silas. He's a sight for sore eyes. That's what he is.
We're home. We made it home.
You did. And you got Fern here, too. Wait till Zeed sees.
He hugs me again, and this time my arms aren't pinned down by his. I hug him back. It's not till Fern talks that I remember there's anybody else watching.
Where's Queenie? She asks.
The minute I let go of Silas and step back to look at him, I know something's wrong. Nobody's come out of the shanty, even with all the racket we've made.
Silas, where's Queenie? Where's Briny?
Silas holds me by the shoulders. His dark eyes stare hard into mine. The corner of his mouth quivers a little.
Your mama died 3 weeks ago, Real. The doctor said it was blood poisoning, but Zeed told me she just had a broke heart. She missed y'all too much.
The news guts me out like a fish. I'm empty inside. My mama's gone from this world. She's gone from this world. And I'll never get to see her again.
Where? Where's Briny? I ask.
Silas holds me tighter. I can tell he's afraid that if he lets go, I'll crumple like a rag doll. For a second, I think I will.
He ain't been well, Real. He took to the bottle after he lost y'all. He's worse since Queenie died. Worse by twice.
Chapter 23 Avery Trent and I stand side by side, gazing up at the ancient columns that line the perimeter of a decaying stone and concrete foundation. They stand like sentinels, military in stature, their feet lost in ivy and lush grass, their hats crowned with carved scrollwork and moss-hued cherubs. A few moments pass before either of us realizes that Jonah has climbed the steps to investigate what must have once been a multi-level veranda. Rusted second-story railings loop along the columns high above our heads, binding them like faded strings of gold braid.
Hey, come on back over here, buddy, Trent calls to Jonah.
The stones look solid, but there's no way of knowing how stable this place is. A plantation house once stood here, tucked on a gentle hill along the Savannah River, not far from Augusta. Whose was it? Nearby, an ice house and other outbuildings stand derelict, their burgundy-shingled roofs slowly decaying, broken timbers poking forth like severed bones. What in the world was my grandmother doing here? It is impossible to imagine Grandma Judy, the woman who fussed if I came in from the barn with horsehair on my breeches and made the mistake of sitting on the furniture, in a place like this. And every Thursday for years? Why?
One thing's for certain. Nobody would bother you here. I doubt if anyone still realizes this place exists.
Trent moves to the steps and reaches for Jonah's hand as the little boy gleefully hops down.
Stay here by Dad, buddy. I know it looks awesome, but there might be a snake.
Jonah stretches upward to see over the foundation.
Where a snake?
I said there might be.
Oh.
I'm momentarily distracted by the two of them. They look like a magazine photo, the bright midday sunlight cascading through the old-growth trees and settling over them, highlighting their sandy blonde hair and look-alike stances. I finally turn back to the remains of the house. It must have been grand in its day. Well, judging by the fact that she used a cab rather than having her own driver bring her, she didn't want anyone to know where she was. I want the truth to be that innocent, but I know better. It's too much of a coincidence that May Crandall mentioned Augusta, and my grandmother has returned here time and time again. This involves the two of them somehow. This is May's place. I know it. Her association with Grandma Judy reaches far beyond working together on some tragic adoption story once upon a time.
Looks like the road continues on down that way.
Trent motions toward the path we've walked from the gate. With grass grown up in the middle and seed heads bowing over the worn tire tracks, it barely qualifies as a road, but it has obviously been both driven on and mowed since last season's growth. Someone was keeping this place up until fairly recently. I guess we should see where it goes. But part of me, most of me, is afraid to know. We start down the road, crossing what was once the lawn. Jonah lifts his legs high with each step, wading through the unmown grass, like he's testing waves along the seashore. Trent swings him up and cups him in one arm as the grass deepens and the path leads us into the trees. Jonah points out birds and squirrels and flowers, making our trek seem innocent. A little nature walk with friends. He wants both his dad and me to comment on his finds. I do my best, but my mind is running a million miles a minute down the hill. Through the trees, I can see water. It's sunlit, slightly ruffled by a breeze. The river, no doubt. Jonah calls me Aberwee. His dad corrects him, saying, "That's Miss Stafford." Trent smiles sideways at me.
"My family's old school. No first names for adults."
"That's nice." I was raised that way, too. Honeybee would have grounded me to my room if I'd failed to properly use Mr. and Mrs. for grown-ups. The rule stood until I was out of college, officially fully grown. Ahead, the path skirts what looks like the remains of a rusted wire garden fence. It's so overgrown with trumpet vines that I don't realize it's actually delineating a yard until we're almost on top of it. There's a tidy little house tucked among red climbing roses and snowy white crepe myrtles. Situated on a gentle hill above the river, it's like an enchanted cottage in a children's fairy tale. The sort of hideaway that would shelter a princess in disguise, or a wise old hermit who was once a king. From the yard's front gate, a boardwalk leads downhill to a dock that leans into the water. Even though the gardens around the house are overgrown right now, they were obviously an elaborate labor of love. Arbors and benches and bird baths wait beside carefully laid stone paths. The little house sits on short piers, prepared to withstand high water. Judging by the weathered wooden window frames and the tin-paneled roof, I'd say it's been here for decades. So this was my grandmother's destination. It's easy to imagine that she enjoyed coming here. This would have been a place where she could leave behind her obligations, her cares, her duties, the family reputation, the public eye, everything that filled those carefully managed appointment books.
You wouldn't know this was here.
Trent admires the little hideaway as we walk around to the front, where a wide-screened porch peeks through the trees. Lace curtains hang inside the front windows. A wind chime sings the sweet, soft music of midday. Twigs and leaves on the steps confirm that no one has swept since before the last set of storms. No, you wouldn't. Is this May Crandall's home? The place where she was discovered keeping company with her sister's dead body? Trent lets us through the crooked gate. It scrapes the stone path, protesting the intrusion.
Looks pretty quiet. Let's see if anyone's home.
We climb the steps together, and he sets Jonah down on the porch as the screen door creaks its way closed behind us. We knock on the door and wait, and finally peer through the lace curtains. Inside, a flowered settee framed with Queen Anne tables and Tiffany lamps seems out of step with the humble river cottage. Paintings and photos line the walls of the small living room, but I can't see them clearly from here. At the far end, there's a kitchen. Doors off the main room appear to lead to bedrooms and a back porch that's been closed in. I've moved to the other window to get a better view when I hear Trent trying the doorknob. "What are you doing?" Glancing over my shoulder, I half expect sirens, or, worse yet, a shotgun aimed our way. Trent winks at me, a mischievous twinkle in his eye as the knob clicks.
"Checking on a potential listing. I think somebody called me to do an appraisal of the place."
He's inside before I have the chance to argue. I'm not sure I would anyway. I can't leave without knowing more, without finding out what's been going on here. It's hard to picture how someone in May's condition could have lived this far off the beaten path.
"Jonah, you stay right there on the porch. No going out the screen door."
Trent casts a commanding look over his shoulder.
"'Kay."
Jonah is busy picking up acorns that some squirrel must have spirited through the torn corner of the screen door. He's counting them when I follow Trent inside.
1, 2, 3, 7, 8, 44.
The count drifts away as I stand on the small rag rug inside the doorway and look around the room. It's not what I expected. There's no layer of dust, no gathering of dead insects along the windowsills. Everything is neat as a pin. There's a definite sense of occupation, but the only sounds come from the wind chime, the birds, the leaves, Jonah's whispery voice, and the call of a river bird. Trent fingers an envelope that's lying on the kitchen counter, twists to look at it.
"May Crandall."
He presents the evidence, but I only half see it. I'm focused on a painting over the fireplace. The bright sun hats, the crisply ironed 60s sundresses, the smiles, the golden curls lifted by the salt breeze, the laughter you can see but not hear. I recognize the scene, if not the exact pose. In this one, the four women are looking at one another and laughing. The boys playing in the sand are gone from the background. The photo I found in Trent Sr.'s workshop was black and white, and the women were smiling for the camera. The snapshot that inspired this painting must have been taken an instant before or after the other one. The portrait artist added the vibrant colors. There is no hue for painting laughter. Yet the captured moment radiates joy. The women stand with their arms linked at the elbows as they throw back their heads. One of them kicks a spray of seawater at the photographer. I move closer to the painting to study the signature in the bottom corner. "Fern," it reads. A brass plate on the frame titles the work, "Sister's Day." My grandmother is on the left. The other three, based on the story told to us at the nursing home, are May, Lark, and Fern. With their heads tipped back in sun rather than shadow over the faces, the women really look like sisters. Even my grandmother.
"That's not the only one."
Trent pivots, surveying the room. Everywhere, there are photographs. Different decades, different locations, an assortment of frames and sizes, but always these same four women. On the dock by the river, their jeans rolled up and fishing poles in their hands, enjoying tea by the climbing roses behind this little house, in red canoes, paddles at the ready. Trent leans over a table, opens a frayed black photo album, and leafs through.
They spend a lot of time here.
I take a step toward him. Suddenly, a dog barks outside. Both of us freeze as the sound rushes closer. Toenails clatter up the porch steps. In four hurried strides, Trent is across the room and out the front door, but he's not fast enough. A big black dog is growling from the other side of the screen, and Jonah stands frozen.
Easy, buddy.
Trent moves forward, grabs Jonah's arm, and shifts him back to me. The dog raises its head and bays, then scratches at the bottom of the door, trying to cram its nose through the torn corner. Not far off, some sort of engine rumbles. A lawnmower, maybe. It's coming our way. Trent and I have no choice but to wait. I don't even dare to close the front door to the house behind us. If the dog breaks through, we'll need an escape. We're like felons caught in the act. Actually, we are felons caught in the act. Only Jonah, who's innocent of any crime, is excited. I keep a hand on his shoulder while he bobs up and down, trying to see what's making the engine noise.
Oh! Tractor! Tractor!
He cheers when a man in overalls and a straw hat comes chugging into view on a red and gray tractor of inestimable age. A faded two-wheeled cart rattles in tow with a weed eater and a few twigs inside. The sun slides over, dappling the man's burnished brown skin as he pulls up near the gate and kills the engine. On closer inspection, I see that he's younger than his garb makes him look. Maybe about my parents' age. In his 60s, perhaps?
Sammy!
His voice is deep and demanding as he steps off the tractor and calls the hound.
You cut that out now. Hush up! Come out of there!
Sammy has his own mind. He waits until the man is almost within reach before obeying the command. The stranger stops halfway up the steps, but he's so tall we're almost eye to eye.
I help you folks?
He asks. Trent and I look at each other. Clearly, neither one of us has planned for this moment.
We were talking to May in the nursing home.
Trent is salesman smooth. He makes that seem like an explanation, even though it really isn't.
Is her house?
I babble, making us look even more guilty.
You got a tractor!
Of the three of us, Jonah has the most intelligent comment.
Yes, sir, I do there, little fellow.
The man braces his hands on his knees to talk to Jonah.
That there was my daddy's tractor. He bought her when she was brand new in 1958. I just come start her up when I get time, knock down the weeds around the farm, pick up the branches, and look in on Mama. The grandbabies love coming with me. I've got one over there right now who's just about your size.
Oh!
Jonah is properly impressed.
I'm free!
He works hard to hold up the three middle fingers on one hand and fold down the pinky and thumb.
Yep, Bart's just about your age then.
The man agrees.
3 and a half. Named after his pawpaw. That's me.
Big Bart straightens back up, studying Trent and me.
You relatives of May's? How's she doing? Mama told me her sister died, and they had to take Mrs. Crandall off to the rest home. Said the grandkids put her in a facility all the way over in Aiken, thinking it'd be better if she wasn't so close to home. Sad thing. She loved this place.
She's doing as well as can be expected, I guess, I tell him. I don't think she likes it very much there. After visiting her house here, I can see why.
You a niece or granddaughter?
He zeroes in on me. I can see him searching his mental catalog, trying to decide who I might be. I'm afraid to lie to the man. No telling whether May even has a granddaughter. Bart might be testing me. A lie won't really solve my problem anyway. I'm not exactly sure, to tell you the truth. You said your mother lives nearby? I wonder if she might know anything about the secret my grandmother was keeping? Pictures in the house and the painting above the fireplace? My grandmother is one of the women in it. Bart gives the cottage a clueless look.
Couldn't say. I haven't been inside in years myself. Mama's been the one to take care of the place here for a long time. Since before the big house got burned down by lightning in 82, even.
Could we possibly talk to her? Would it be too much of an imposition? He tips back his hat, smiling.
My mercy, not a bit. She loves it when anybody comes to visit. Just be sure you've got time to kill. Mama can talk.
He leans back and looks around the edge of the cabin.
Did y'all walk down here on foot from the old house? There's an easier route out right through there. Little driveway up to the farm lane. May kept her car parked in the garage by Mama's place.
Oh, I didn't know. But that explains a few things, like the overgrown condition of the front entrance and the rough trail that led us here. We walked in from the old iron gate.
Oh, slap, you'll have chiggers by tomorrow. Remind me to give you some of Mama's chigger soap. She makes it herself.
I immediately start itching.
Y'all hop in my little box trailer there. I'll give you a ride over to Mama's house. Unless you just as soon walk.
I look across the way, and all I see are billions of chiggers waiting to attach themselves to me and make me itch for all eternity. Jonah is already vibrating in place and tugging his daddy's pant leg and pointing at the tractor.
I think we'll ride, Trent decides.
Jonah claps and cheers, seconding the motion.
You come on then, young fella.
Bart opens the screen door, and Jonah reaches for him as if he's an old friend. He swings Jonah into the air and down the steps, and it's clear that Bart is experienced at this kind of thing. Obviously, he's a top-notch grandpa. Jonah is in heaven when we climb into the little two-wheeled wooden trailer, which reminds me of the manure wagon the stable hands use at Drayden Hill. I even suspect this cart may have been employed the same way. Suspicious-looking substances bounce around underneath the pile of twigs. Jonah doesn't mind a bit. He looks happy as a duck in a puddle as we motor through some underbrush at the edge of the yard and follow what is clearly a well-used trail, perhaps for a four-wheeler or a golf cart. Our route runs away from the river, taking us to a rural road, where we turn in to the first driveway. The freshly painted blue house looks like the sort of place where an old farm wife would live. Chickens peck in the yard. A spotted milk cow lounges under a shade tree. Laundry flaps lazily on a multi-strand clothesline. Sammy bounds ahead, barking and baying to announce our arrival. Bart's mother shuffles onto the porch dressed in a colorful muumuu, house shoes, and a bright yellow scarf. A matching silk flower adorns the fluffy gray bun atop her head. When she sees us in the tractor cart, she draws back and shades her eyes.
Who you got there, Bartholomew?
I let her son offer an explanation, since I don't have one.
They were over at Mrs. Crandall's place. Said they'd been to visit her in the nursing home.
The old woman's chin disappears into the leathery, cinnamon-colored folds of her neck.
Who you say you is?
I climb off the wagon before she can decide to have her son take us back where he found us. Avery! It's only two steps onto her porch, and I hurriedly offer my hand to shake hers. I was asking your son about the pictures and the paintings over at May's house. My grandmother is in them. The old woman glances from me to Trent, who's waiting at the bottom of the steps while Jonah investigates the tractor with Bart. A boy about Jonah's size emerges from a nearby barn and runs across the yard to join them. Introductions aren't needed, but they're quickly offered. This is little Bart. The old woman turns her attention to me again. She cranes upward and looks long and hard, as if she's mapping the contours of my face, comparing them to something. Is it my imagination, or is there a spark of recognition?
Now, who you say you is?
Avery, I repeat more loudly this time.
Avery who?
Stafford. I purposely haven't offered that information until now, but I don't want to leave here without answers. And if this is what it takes, this is what it takes.
You Miss Judy's daughter?
My heart starts pumping so hard I can feel my eardrums pulsating. Granddaughter. Time seems to slow down. I lose all consciousness of little boy chatter and tractor talk and Big Bart and chickens clucking and the cow swatting flies and the endless song of a mockingbird.
You want to know about that place next door? About why she go there?
It's not a question, but a statement. As if this woman has been waiting for years, knowing that sooner or later someone would come asking. Yes, ma'am, I do. I'd ask my grandmother, but to tell you the truth, she's not doing all that well mentally. She can't remember things. She shakes her head slowly, her tongue making a soft tisk, tisk, tisk. When she focuses on me again, she says,
What the mind don't remember, the heart still know. Love, the strongest thing of all. Stronger than all the rest. You want to know about the sisters?
Please, I whisper. Yes, please tell me.
It ain't my secret to tell.
She turns and shuffles toward the house, and for a moment I think I've been dismissed. But a quick glance over her shoulder tells me otherwise. I'm being asked to follow her inside.
Told to.
I stop just past the threshold, waiting while she opens the slant top on an oak secretary desk and draws out a dented tin crucifix. From beneath it, she takes three rumpled sheets of paper originally torn off a yellow legal pad. Even though they've been wrinkled and then straightened, they don't look particularly old, and they're certainly not of the same vintage as the pressed tin piece.
I only took it for safekeeping, the woman says.
She hands me the tin piece and the papers separately.
That cross been Queenie's, long time ago. Miss Judy write the other. It's her story, but she never write the rest. They decide they all gonna carry it to their graves, I guess. But I figure somebody might come asking one day. Secrets ain't a healthy thing. Secrets ain't a healthy thing, no matter how old they is. Sometimes the oldest secrets is the worst of all. You take your grandmother to see Miss Bay. The heart still know. It still know who it loves.
I look down at the crucifix, turn it over in my hand, then unfold the yellow sheets. I recognize the handwriting. It's my grandmother's. I've looked at enough of her day books to be certain.
Sit down, child.
Bart's mother guides me to a wing chair. I half sit and half collapse. The top of the page reads, Prelude, Baltimore, Maryland, August 3rd, 1939. The date of my grandmother's birthday and the place she was born.
My story begins on a sweltering August night, in a place I will never set eyes upon. The room takes life only in my imaginings. It is large most days when I conjure it. The walls are wide and clean, the bed linens crisp as a fallen leaf. The private suite has the very finest of everything.
I float through time, tumbling back years and decades, moving through space to a hospital room in August 1939, to a tiny life that enters the world and leaves it in the same moment, to blood and grief and an exhausted young mother who sinks into merciful sleep. There are the whispered conversations of powerful men. A grandfather who, for all his wealth and position, cannot save his tiny grandchild. He is an important man. A congressman, perhaps? He cannot rescue his daughter. Or can he? I know of a woman in Memphis. A desperate choice is made. This is where the written story ends, and where another story begins. The saga of a fair-haired infant girl who, if Georgia Tan's sordid history is any indication, is taken from her mother immediately after birth. Falsified papers are signed, or perhaps the exhausted new mother is simply told that her child was stillborn. The baby is spirited away in Georgia's arms, secretly delivered to a waiting family that will claim her as their own and bury their desperate secret. The tiny girl becomes Judy Myers Stafford. This is the truth my heart has been reaching for since the day I saw the faded photograph on May's nightstand and was struck by the resemblance. The photo in the nursing home is of Queenie and Briny. They aren't just people from May Crandall's remembrances. They are my great-grandparents. River gypsies. I might have been one myself, had fate not taken an unthinkable twist. Bart's mother moves to the space beside me. She sits on the arm of the wing chair and rubs my back and hands me a handkerchief as my tears flow.
Oh, honey, oh, child, the best thing is to know. I always tell them. Best to be who you is, what you is deep down inside. Ain't no other good way of living. But it ain't my decision to make.
I'm not sure how long I sit there, the old woman patting and soothing while I contemplate all the things that kept the children of the Arcadia from one another. I think of the way May explained their choices.
We were young women with lives and husbands and children by the time we were brought together again. We chose not to interfere with one another. It was enough for each of us to know that the others were well.
But the truth is, it wasn't enough. Even the ramparts of reputation and ambition and social position couldn't erase the love of sisters, their bond with one another. Suddenly, the barriers that created their need for hidden lives and secret meeting places seem almost as cruel as those of brokered adoptions, altered paperwork, and forced separations.
You take your grandmother to see her sister.
A trembling hand squeezes mine.
They the only two left. The only two sisters. You tell them Hootsie says it's time to be who they is.
Chapter 24 Rill. The whippoorwill call tries to take me from my dream, but I push it away and hold on. In the dream, we're all on board the Arcadia, Briny and Lark and Fern and Gabion. We're drifting down the wide Mississippi, full out in the middle, just like we own the deed on the whole big river. The day is clear and fine, and there's not a tugboat or a barge or a sternwheeler in sight. We're free. We're free, and we're letting the river take us south, far, far away from Mud Island and everything that happened there. Silas and Zed are with us too, and Camellia, and Queenie. That's how I know the whole thing isn't true. I open my eyes and toss off the blanket, and for a minute, I'm sunblind and lost. It's the middle of the day, not nighttime. Then I realize I'm curled in the skiff with Fern, and we were squirreled up under the ragged canvas, not a blanket. The skiff is tied to the back of the Arcadia, heading nowhere. It's the only place we can go to rest during the day, and be sure Briny won't sneak up on us. The whippoorwill call comes again. It's Silas, I know. I look for him in the brush, but he's got himself hidden. I wriggle from under the canvas, and Fern wakes up and grabs my ankle. Since we've come back to the Arcadia, she's scared to be by herself even for a minute. She's never sure whether Briny will push her away so hard she falls down, or grab her up and hold her so tight she can't breathe. I answer the whippoorwill call, and Fern scrambles up trying to see into the woods. "Shh," I whisper. When we snuck out to the skiff this morning, Briny was rambling around with a bottle of whiskey. He's probably asleep on the porch by now. I just can't be sure. We better not let Briny find out Silas is here. Fern nods and licks her lips. Her tummy rumbles. She probably knows that Silas will bring us something to eat. If it weren't for Silas and old Zed and Arnie, we would have starved to death in the 3 weeks we've been back on the Arcadia. Briny hasn't got much need for food. He mostly lives on whiskey now. I lift the canvas up for Fern. You go back under there a minute. If Briny sees that Silas came over and starts into a fit about it, I don't want Fern in the way. I have to peel her off to put her back under the canvas, but she stays. Silas is waiting in the brush. He hugs me hard, and I bite my lip to keep from crying. We move off a little farther together, but not so far that I can't hear Fern if she needs me. "You all right?" Silas asks when we sit down in the clear spot under a tree. I nod. Fishing wasn't any good this morning, though. I don't want to ask for food, but I'm hoping that's what's in the little poke he's carrying. He hands over a bundle no bigger than 2 fists, but it means a lot. Zed's supplies are running low, and he's got Arnie to feed, too. She's moved onto his boat, where she'll be safe. Zed wanted Fern and me to go too, but I know Briny won't hurt us. Some flapjacks and a little salt fish. An apple you can split up. Silas leans back on his hands, pulls a breath, and looks through the brambles toward the river. "Briny any better today? He coming around at all?"
"A little."
I'm not sure if it's true, or if I just want it to be. Briny mostly wanders around the boat and drinks and yells at night. Then he sleeps it off during the day. Zed says we'll have rain this evening. I've seen the rain signs too. It worries me. Don't come back and try to untie the lines again, all right? Not yet. Maybe in a few more days. A few more days and I think Briny will be ready. For 2 weeks, we stayed in at the bank across from Mud Island while the weather's turned colder. Even though Silas and Zed warned Briny, it'd be easy for the police to find us here if they come looking. Briny won't let anybody unhitch the shorelines. He almost shot Silas's hand off for trying. He nearly shot poor Arnie, too. I gave her some of Queenie's clothes to use, and Briny decided she was Queenie, and he was mad at her for dying. "Just a little longer," I plead with Silas. Silas rubs his ears like that's not what he wants to hear. "You ought to bring Fern and come onto Zed's boat with me. We'll move her down into the main channel and see if Briny don't come along."
"Just a few more days. Briny'll get better. He's gone out of his head for a while, that's all. It'll pass. I hope I'm right. But the truth is that Briny doesn't want to leave Queenie, and Queenie's buried in the thick Mississippi soil not far from here. A Catholic priest said final words over her, Zeed told me. I never even knew my mama was a Catholic. Until I lived with the Sevieres, I didn't even know what that meant. Zuma wore a little cross like the one on our shanty wall. She'd hold it and talk to it sometimes, just the way Queenie did, but not in Polish. The Sevieres didn't care for that too much, because they're Baptists. I figure either way, it's a comfort to know my mama was buried proper, and a preacher was there to say prayers at her grave. Zeed wants you to tell Briny that in 4 days at the outside, he's moving our boat, and if Briny don't want to come along, he's taking you and Fern off the Arcadia. You're going down water with us.
Who's out there?
Briny's voice booms from somewhere near shore. The words are thick with leftover liquor. He must have heard Silas talking.
Who's out here around?
Briny comes crashing through the brush and dead grass. I grab the poke, tuck it under my dress, and shoo Silas away. Briny staggers around while I slip away to the skiff, gather up Fern, and take her to the shanty. Briny finds us there when he finally comes back. I pretend like I've just fried the flapjacks up in the skillet. He doesn't even notice there's no fire in the stove. I've got supper almost ready. I make a show of dishing up plates. You hungry? He blinks and scoops up Fern and sits down at the table and holds her tight. She watches me, her face pale and scared. A fist grabs my throat. How am I going to tell Briny that Zeed's only waiting 4 more days? I can't, so I say. Flapjacks and salt fish and apple slices. I put the food on the table, and Briny sets Fern in her place. It feels just like we've been having a proper meal together every single day. For a while, everything's like it should be. Briny smiles at me through dark, tired eyes that remind me of Camellia. I miss my sister, even if we did fight all the time. I miss how tough and stubborn she was, how she never gave in. Zeed says 4 days yonder the currents will be good and it's time to take to the river. Go down water where the fishing's fine and the weather's warm. He says it's time. Briny braces an elbow on the table and rubs his eyes, shaking his head slowly back and forth. His words are muddled, but I hear the last few anyway.
Not without Queenie.
He gets up and heads for the door, grabbing his empty whiskey bottle on the way. A minute later, I hear him rowing off in the skiff. I listen until he's gone, and in the quiet that's left after, I feel like the world is coming down around me. When I was at Mrs. Murphy's, and then the Sevier's house, I thought if I could just get back to the Arcadia, that'd fix everything. I thought it'd fix me. But now I see I was fooling myself. Just to keep on going, one day to the next. Truth is, instead of fixing everything, the Arcadia made everything real. Camellia's gone. Lark and Gabian are far away. Queenie's buried in a pauper's grave. And Briny's heart went there with her. He's lost his mind to whiskey. And he doesn't want to come back. Not even for me. Not even for Fern. We're not enough. Fern crawls into my lap, and I hold tight to her. We wait out the evening listening for signs of Briny, but nobody comes. He's probably gone into town to hustle pool halls until he can get some more to drink. Finally, I tuck Fern into her bunk and slip into mine and lay there trying to find sleep. There's not even a book to keep me company. Everything that can buy whiskey has already been traded off. Rain starts before I fall asleep, but there's still no sign of Briny. I find him in my dream. We're whole, and everything's the way it should be. Briny plays his harmonica as we picnic in the sand along the shore. We pick daisies and taste honeysuckle. Gabian and Lark chase after little frogs until they've caught a whole jarful. Ain't your mama pretty as a queen? Briny asks. And what's that make you? Why, Princess Rill of Kingdom Arcadia, of course.
When I wake up, I hear Briny outside, but there's no music. He's hollering into the deepening storm. Sweat sticks the bedsheet to my skin, so I have to peel it off as I sit up. My mouth is pasty and dry, and my eyes don't want to clear. The air around is black as pitch. Rain rattles the roof. The wood stove has been filled, and the damper must have been turned wide open, because it's crackling and whistling, and the room is boiling hot. Outside the shanty, Briny cusses a blue streak. A lantern flashes by the window. I swing my feet around to get up, but the boat sways crazy wild, knocking me back onto the ticking. The Arcadia bobs side to side. Fern rolls clean over the rail on her bunk and tumbles onto the floor in a heap. All of a sudden, I know. We're not tied up on shore anymore. We're on the water. Silas and Zeed came and cut us loose after Briny got back. That's the first thing I think. He's out there hollering because he's mad they did it. But just as quick, I'm sure they wouldn't set us adrift at night. It's too dangerous, with the logs and sandbars, and the wakes from the big boats and barges. Silas and Zeed know that. Briny does too, but he's half out of his mind out there. He's not trying to get us to shore. He's daring the river to take us.
Come on, you blackguard! He hollers, like Captain Ahab and Moby Dick. Try and win! Take me! Come on!
Thunder booms. Lightning crackles. Briny cusses at the river. He laughs. The lantern disappears from the window, then bobs up the side ladder as Briny climbs onto the roof. I stumble across the room to check on Fern and put her back in her bunk.
You stay there. Stay until I tell you different.
She grabs my nightgown, croaks out,
No!
Since we've been back on the Arcadia, she's been scared to death at night.
It'll be all right. I think the lines came loose, that's all. Briny's probably trying to get us back ashore.
I hurry on, leaving her there in the bed. The Arcadia wobbles as I stagger across the floor, and a tug blows its horn, and I hear the creaks and pings of barge hulls, and I know that bigger wakes are coming. I reach out for the door and grab on just in time. The Arcadia rises up awake, then tips hard coming down. Wood slides through my fingernails, driving splinters underneath. I fall forward, land on the porch in the cold. The boat nods the other direction, spinning sideways to the current.
No, no, please, no!
The Arcadia rights herself, like she's heard me. She rides the next swell clean and slick.
You think you can take me? You think you can take me?
Briny yells from up top. A bottle shatters, and glass tumbles down from the porch roof, glistening in the night rain and the tug's searchlight. It seems to fall slow. Then it plinks into the black water.
Briny, we've got to get her ashore,
I yell.
Briny, we got to tie up.
But the tug's horn and the storm whip my voice from my mouth. A man someplace yells curses and warnings. An emergency whistle sounds. The Arcadia rises up a huge wake, balances like a dancer on tiptoes. She lists as she falls. Cold water rushes over the porch. We spin sideways to the river. The tug's light sweeps and catches us. A piece of drift aims itself for our bow. A giant strainer tree with all the roots and dirt still attached. I see it just before the light moves on. I scramble for the boat hook to push it away, but the pole isn't where it should be. There's nothing I can do but hug the porch post and yell to Fern to hang on and watch the tree hit, its roots spreading around the Arcadia like fingers, catching my ankle, turning and pulling hard. Inside the cabin, Fern screams my name.
Hold on! Hold on tight! I yell.
The tree pulls and rips, twirling the Arcadia like a spinning top,
whirling her around, then breaking free and leaving us listing in the current. The wakes come over us hard,